Blog Talk Radio.
Ms. Burton, tell me, what was the year that changed everything for you?
I can not only tell you the year, but the actual date. It was October 4th of 1997 that my life changed for the better. But 1981, my life sort of fell into an abyss of darkness when I lost my son. And October 4th of 1997 is when I began to get a hold and get it back on track. So
let's talk about getting it back on track. What did that mean for you?
That meant accessing the level of services I needed to repair the trauma, the loss, and addiction.
And before that, though, you had no access to this. So how did you find, make the opportunity to get better for yourself?
So I think it was a matter of it being time or way past time and the opportunity to access. I want to say it was luck or divine intervention. You know, it's, you know, all of these things that work together to help me to pull myself up and together.
And so this book, Becoming Mrs. Burton, what does that mean and why is it important that you have put this book out?
Yeah, well, Becoming Miss Burton talks about the journey from being this woman named Sue to becoming the Miss Burton. And Miss Burton is respected and loved in her community. Sue was kind of beaten, battered, and not really supported or loved by the community. So those are the two different parts. And the book is in two parts. One is part one, Sue, and part two is Miss Burton.
Okay.
Yes.
All right. So for other women that may be in similar situations, what do you want them to know about the direction their life could potentially take?
I want them to understand that, you know, to take hold of whatever resources are available and fight for their life and their right to be. It's not easy in the way the world operates. You can easily get caught in a circle of confusion. You know, we have to, one, help one another, and two, we have to be strong enough to and wise enough to pull ourselves out of situations that could essentially bury us and lose us.
Wonderful.
Yeah.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
So, Paul, let's talk about this fear that people have of the black man, and where does it come from, and where? How do you think it's being perpetuated?
You know, we don't know where it comes from. Sometimes people say it's about fear of crime. But if you look at some of the ways we get treated, studies show that people take twice as long to stop for a black man in a crosswalk. People don't want to sit next to us on the subway. They don't want to sit next to me in Southwest, where you get to choose your own seat. There's a joke that black men love Southwest because we get more legroom. So that's not about fear of crime. It's just this general anxiety about African-American people that I think is tied to a history of slavery. And they had to dehumanize us in order to justify treating us like property, and that attitude still persists. So when you look at our criminal justice system, not only are the police more likely to shoot us, more likely to beat us up, they do it in legal ways, like stop and frisk, when they put their hands all over our bodies. A lot of brothers experience that as sexual harassment. A lot of things, when they happen to black men, we don't look at them the same way that they happen to as when they happen to other women. If we had a system where police could routinely put their hands on people, feel in their bodies, especially if it were white women, everybody would recognize that as a form of sexual harassment. And it happens to African-American men, and I don't know one brother who hasn't been stopped and frisked by the police. It's harder to see the degradation, the sexual humiliation. That really is the point of a lot of police practices when it comes to black men.
That's a very good point. So let's also talk about the issue in our own community, within our own people, because you address this too in the book about the black-on-black crime and the black-on-black violence and how we can keep our communities safe within ourselves.
You know, we have to look at the reasons why people are in situations where they resort to violence, and it's the same as the reasons why we get treated differently by the police. It's all about these structural inequalities where black people live in, many black people live in high poverty, segregated neighborhoods, and these are desperate situations that sometimes make people act out. And when we look at the ways that we can address that situation, when you have these high poverty neighborhoods and easy access to guns, that's a recipe for violence. And yet, as a society, we're unwilling to do anything about the widespread availability of guns. And so when we look at it, things that happen, even in Sandy Hook, and a lot of us thought, you know, if a gunman goes after children in a suburb of Connecticut and kills little babies, and that doesn't lead to a change in our gun laws, then nothing will, and certainly not the routine slaughter of African-American women and men that happens. Unfortunately, that does not move many of the Republican Congress folks who just insist on opening up even more gun laws. So as long as we have this easy access to guns, along with these high poverty segregated neighborhoods, we're going to continue to have black people being at high risk for violence. It's not like there's nothing we can do. We just don't have the political will to do it.
Okay. And so what about making lasting change in law enforcement so that everybody feels, not necessarily just feels safe, but so that everybody is actually safe?
You know, I don't think there's a way that we can do what we ask the criminal law to do, which is to select out who's the most dangerous and who's the most immoral. We can't do that in a way that's not all about race and class. And so I think we have to do what the Movement for Black Lives asked, which is to abolish prison. When you first hear about that, it sounds crazy. But when we think about what we hope prisons do, which is to make people accountable for what they've done and also to prevent harm, prison doesn't do either one of those very well. And within our communities, we're learning ways to deal with moments of crisis that don't involve calling the police. A lot of times, if you're in trouble, if you're having a crisis, calling someone with a gun and the power to arrest makes things worse, not better. So there's all kinds of vulnerable communities that are thinking creatively about ways to deal with issues, with tensions and conflicts that don't involve resorting to the state, because there's so much potential for violence and abuse.
And last question, now that chokehold is out, what do you want people to get out of it? What do you want the lesson to be for those who read it and for those that need to read it?
I want people to understand that the problem now is not bad apple cops. The problem is the system is working the way it's supposed to. So we need to disrupt this system. We need to do what President Obama recommended in his speech at Selma, which was the 50th anniversary of police wilding out on black people. And what Obama said is we need to transform this nation. Every 100 years ago, African Americans come along and save this country. So we did it when we got rid of slavery. We did it when we got rid of the old Jim Crow. We need to do it now to get rid of the new Jim Crow. And the way to do that is to imagine a world without prisons.
Wonderful. Thank you. Following the interviews, the authors held their book author talk, starting with Ms. Burton. She began her discussion with two of her earliest memories. The first was when she was a child riding in the car with her family to pick up the boyfriend of her aunt from a mental facility. In the car, she'd count the trees along the road to the facility, and she knew that when she got to the 22nd tree, they'd be at the facility and the man would get in the car and later do things to her that she knew weren't right, but she didn't know how to discuss. The next memory was of her father.
So I had five brothers, and I was the only girl. And those two, and my father, being a proud black man, deindustrialization started taking place, and he lost his job, and seemed like with his job went all of his oomph. And, you know, he began to drink, and then there would be fights in the house, and nobody knew that all the jobs were being shipped out. you know, and I would hear him and my mother fussing and fighting, and eventually my father left the home. You know, I remember welfare workers coming in, searching our house and my mom's closet, because if a man lived there, she couldn't get welfare. And I think that played into their separation. But those are my earliest memories. And then there was trauma on top of trauma that happened throughout my young life and into my teens. And, you know, but I learned to navigate all of that and kind of just hold on and trade off one bad thing for another bad thing, because I could deal with the results of one bad thing better than the other bad thing. And finally, I couldn't deal with it anymore when my 5-year-old son was accidentally killed. And I began to drink, and that escalated to drug use. He was killed by an LAPD police officer, and the police officer never got out of the car, and the department never said, "Ms. Burton, I'm sorry." And I began to drink, and then it escalated to drug use, and that drug use sent me to prison. And after almost 20 years of cycling in and out of prison, I found treatment. I found treatment in Santa Monica, a beach community, just down the 10th Freeway. And in that community, I found that people who were arrested and had drug problems was treated differently than in South LA, where I was from. They were remanded to drug treatment. I was remanded to prison. And that happened 6 times. And it was pretty evident that I had a drug problem, a grief problem, a trauma problem, and never through the court system. I remember going in, I threw myself on the mercy of the judge, and I said, "Judge, these things have happened in my life. Can, you know, I get some help?" And I was sent to prison. So when I got to Santa Monica, and there was just this huge pleather, huge buffet of services, I began to intake from a variety of services. I went to treatment every week. I went to, I was introduced to the AA program. In a few months, I'll be 20 years sober. I just found, you know, all of these. Thank you. All of these services, I work with steps, I got a sponsor, still work with the sponsor, still go to meetings, I just got better. But then I began to examine what happened to my life and examine the contrast of what happened in South LA, what happened in Santa Monica, and I got a job and after 100 days of treatment, I got a job taking care of this lady named Miss Andrews. And she asked me to move in with her, and I was able to save money. And with saving money, I was able to buy a little house. And when I got that little house, I would go down to the bus station, downtown Skid Row in Los Angeles, where we all came back from the prisons, and I would meet my friends that I did time with and offer them a place to live. And that created a new way of life reentry project. And now the program is about 18 years old, and we have 5 homes. It's been lifted. It's been shown as a model reentry program for the nation. We have, you know, like legal department, organizing, policy, and we just sort of kicking up a little dust around there. You know, over 1,000 women have been back through the home, and we have a legal staff of 6 attorneys, the organizing, the policy, and the distribution center. So I was praying about keeping the house nice, keeping the 2 houses nice, and Bed Bath & Beyond called me and told me to bring a 40-foot truck. And I brought the 40-foot truck to the Bed Bath & Beyond store, and they stuffed it from front to back. And ever since that time, they give about up to $2 million a year in product. And we give it away to the to the larger community, and we keep our houses nice. So the book, I've been told, is a thriller. One woman called me and said, "Oh, Susan, this is a thriller." I said, "It's not a thriller, it's a memoir." You know, some people told me that they have to put it down after reading a chapter because they just can't imagine the things that being done to a person that I had to live through. Others say that they can't put it down. So I think it's a really good read, but it talks about, you know, what happens to women who are traumatized. 85% of women who have had, 85% of women in prison have experienced some traumatic abuse, sexual abuse, and so forth in their lifetime, and it's gone untreated. It's gone unnoticed. And in the larger world, we're not talking about, in the whole criminal justice sort of conversation, we're not talking about women, but we are the fastest growing prison population, fastest growing segment of the prison population. So I hope the book, I'll be able to use that as a tool, as I'm doing now, to talk about this. And there are better solutions. There are better ways and ways to address trauma and alternatives to putting people in cages and traumatizing them. You know, I remember feeling like, I remember standing in a room about with these many people, and we were all stripped buck naked, and people were shining flashlights on our body parts, and I thought, is this what my ancestors went through?
Ooh.
You know, and then we were chained together and walked out and put on the bus. And it was about 3 a.m. And I thought, is this how we were captured in the jungles of Africa back some time early in the morning and driven off or put on a boat or driven off in the dark of the night? So all of that is in the book. So that's my kind of story. I hope I told you the whole book.
Thank you so much to the source for having us. It feels like such a almost spiritual place, which is wonderful to be here with you. The first thing I want to say is buy and read this lady's book. It's it'll make you mad. It'll move you, and it'll inspire you. She's one of my heroes. I'm not just saying that because she was a CNN hero, but she's actually a hero in real life as well, and it's an honor to be part of this program with her. So, as they say in hip-hop, allow me to reintroduce myself. My name is Paul Butler, and I represent the people. That's how I used to start my opening statement. I was a prosecutor in D.C. I represented the government and criminal court, and I used that power to put black men in prison. And black women, and poor people, and Latinos. Like a lot of prosecutors, that was pretty much all I did. From the time I did that work, I learned some things. Chokehold is about what I learned. Chokehold started as a guide to black men about how to avoid being caught up in the system. How not to get stopped by police if you get stopped, how not to get arrested if you get arrested, how to go forward. And in part, it was based on my 20 years of research, my training at law school, and my experience as a prosecutor. But it was also based on my experience as a black man. During the time that I was a prosecutor, I had the most high-profile case in the Department of Justice. I was prosecuting a United States senator for public corruption. And during that time, I got arrested and prosecuted for a crime that I didn't commit. And things worked out fine for me. And the reason things worked out fine for me is because I hired the best lawyer in town, an African-American woman named Michelle Roberts. I hired her because I had the resources to be able to afford to hire her. things worked out fine for me because I had skills. I literally have prosecuted people in the courtroom where I was being prosecuted. Things worked out fine for me because I had a kind of social standing. We made sure the jurors knew that I was a lawyer, that I wasn't the kind of black man who they would want to send to prison. And the other reason things worked out fine for me is because I was innocent. But that didn't seem like the most important reason at all. And so I couldn't be a prosecutor anymore after that. And when I wrote this book, I started out again wanting other people to know that the system is unfair. It doesn't matter whether you did it or not. If I beat my case, I wanted other folks to know how they could beat my case, how they could beat their case. So I was working on that book. And while I was working on that idea, Trayvon Martin got killed. Sandra Bland got tortured. Police in McKinney, Texas beat up a little girl in a bikini. Michael Brown, Eric Garner. Suddenly, a guy for black men didn't seem to rise to the occasion. And so that became a chapter, and it's still one of my favorite chapters, because it's real talk from, again, somebody who's been inside about how, if you are caught up in the system, you can have a better outcome. But the rest of the book is about what's going on with the police and black men. And the idea there is not about bad apple cops. The system is working the way it's supposed to. It's broke on purpose. We give police all these powers with the idea that they will use them mainly against African-American people, and especially black men. So what I'm trying to do is take an intersectional look at black men. A lot of the things that happen to us happen because we are black, but also because we are male. And in writing about black men, I want to avoid making a mistake that a lot of other people who focus on us have made, which is that we are no worse off than black women. In fact, in a lot of ways, black women have it worse than we do. So it's not about a race to the bottom, but it's about understanding that intersectionality means that we have to not only look at the fact that we're black, but also look at the fact that we're male. The way that black men get treated has also often had a gender component. So it wasn't enough that black men had to be lynched, then their penises had to be cut off and stuffed in their mouths. We see this with regard to police treatment of African-American men. In Philly, they used to come and arrest the Panthers. They would make them take all of their clothes off, the men, and take photos of them. A lot of you know that Abner Louima was raped by a cop with a broom handle. In Choco, I describe stop and frisk as a form of sexual harassment. The police stop you for basically any reason they want, and they put their hands all over your body. A lot of brothers experience that as a sexual invasion, but it's harder to recognize. When things happen to black men, sometimes we think of them differently than we do of when they happen to other people. So the chokehold, it's a literal thing. It's how the NYPD killed Eric Garner. It's what police do when they want you to do what they say, but you can't because you cannot breathe. But the chokehold also has a figurative meaning. For black men, it's two parts. The first part is this idea that we're thugs, that we're criminals. So every black man, every time he leaves his house, you have to decide, am I going to engage in this performance today that lets everybody know that I'm okay, that I'm not a threat? It could be things as basic as wearing your high school t-shirt, displaying your work ID, crossing the street so people don't feel like you're trying to follow them. Sometimes you do that, and sometimes you just can't deal with it that day. You just want to be you. So part one is this idea, and lots of really interesting social science that I talk about in Choco, about how people think about us. It takes folks twice as long to stop for us at a crosswalk than it does other people.
A lot of brothers have talked about people not wanting to sit next to us in subways. So there was a professor actually, who wrote about taking Amtrak, the train where you can choose your own seat. He said his seat, the seat next to him, is always the last to be taken. A sports journalist on ESPN, J.J. Adene, talked about that same effect on Southwest Airlines, where you get to choose your own seat. He says that there's a brother in the aisle seat and a brother in the window seat. That middle seat's the last to go. He said brothers love Southwest because we get more legroom. So people think of us as thugs, as criminals. And then the law responds. And in Chokehold, I talk about all this amazing research. So a lot of people know that the law responds by giving the police all this power to racially profile, to arrest, to use deadly force. But some of the stuff I talked about, you just wouldn't believe. So, for example, in Connecticut, there's a police department that you have to take a test like you do for most police departments to be on the force. If you score too high in this test, you're disqualified because they think you're too smart, you shouldn't be a cop. A guy who got a great score, didn't get the job for that reason, he sued. Connecticut Supreme Court said, that's fine. Nothing wrong with that qualification. You really can't be too smart to be a cop. The Supreme Court has said that if you are intellectually disabled, you can't be executed because you can't comprehend why you're being killed by the government. The way that states measure your disability is by giving you an IQ test. In some states, if a black person takes the test, they add 10 to 15 points to the IQ on the grounds that the test discriminates against black people. And that bumps the guy up to where he can be executed. This is perfectly legal. So this is how the law responds to us. So in Choco, the last thing I'll talk about is the solution. So there's some reform stuff that we can do. In Choco, I suggest if we want to make the police treat folk better, there are two things we could do right now. One is to require that officers, half of police departments be women. And the other is that college degrees, officers ought to be required to have college degrees. Those are proven evidence-based ways of having officers who are more like the guardians who President Obama recommended police be, and not so much like the warriors. Police are rarely prosecuted for killing folks. They kill about 1,000 people a year. In 10 years, there have been fewer than 50 prosecutions. Most people have been prosecuted, have been found not guilty. And again, the reason for that, it's not about the jurors or the prosecutors, it's because the law gives the police all that power. But when we look at the gender breakdown, only two women cops out of those 50 have been prosecuted. Doesn't mean that women cops are all good, but in terms of just a way of having folks be safer in the streets, women cops are much better at working out conflicts without taking out their guns. And the same thing is true of college-educated folks. They tend to be, again, not my guess, just scientific evidence-based, they tend to be better at not arresting and shooting their way out of issues. And I also think we have to think more broadly about disrupting the system. And the way to do that is to think about abolishing prison. Sounds crazy. Okay. Abolition. Every movement for racial justice in this country for African American people has been about abolition. Abolition of slavery, abolition of segregation, the old Jim Crow. So now we have to think about abolition of the new Jim Crow. The reason that sounds scary to some people is because they think, well, without prison, something would happen. Well, what is it that we think prison does? What we hope it does is keep us safe and make people who've caused harm accountable for what they've done. Ms. Burton knows, many of you know, prison doesn't do either one of those. It does not make us safer because people don't get the kinds of services that they need when they're locked up. And it does not make folks accountable when they've caused harm. When I was a prosecutor, I would tell the defense attorney, if you don't make we go through the trouble of a trial, then your God will give 2 years. If you put me to the trouble of a trial, and your client is convicted, and he will be, I'm asking for 10 years. What would you do? So that's why we don't have a trial system anymore. We have a plea bargaining system, 95%. 95% of people plead guilty. So people aren't responsible. They're not accountable for what they've done. They're pleading guilty because otherwise I would throw the book at them. And when people wonder about abolition, they always want to think about the 5%, except they don't know it's 5%. They think it's much larger. The 5% are people who cause extreme harm. They've killed somebody, or they've sexually violated somebody. You looked at who's locked up, that's only 5%. People say, well, what about them? The answer is, I don't know. But we could start working on the 95% who haven't caused the most extreme harm right now. Abolition does not mean opening every door of every prison tomorrow, but a conservative estimate is 40% right now. So people who have self-medicated with drugs, they don't need to be locked up. We're not safer with them. We're, in some ways, we're worse off with them locked up. Older folks, there's so many people locked up now that some prisons are literally operating assisted living facilities. If you're 55, 60, you're not going to cause harm if you're on the outside. You don't deserve to be in prison. It's not doing anybody any good. So again, it's an idea that you're going to be hearing a lot more about the African-American revolutionary. Another one of my heroes, Angela Davis, is probably the most famous person to talk about this idea. So what I'm trying to do as a prosecutor, somebody who's worked inside the system, is to think about it in a practical way. What would it mean? So I'll close by saying that Clarence Thomas on the Supreme Court used to be a judge in D.C. And he said that when he would look out of his window and he'd see all these black men going into criminal court in chains, just like Susan described, in chains. And he said he would think, there but for the grace of God go I. President Obama, he spoke at the NAACP a few years ago, same phrase, there but for the grace of God go I. My friends, the determination of who goes to criminal court in chains should not be so fortuitous. Mm-hmm. It should not depend so much on race and class. As long as it does, we need to have these conversations. We need to listen to Susan Burton. We need to resist until that system is brought down. Thank you.